morning, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Jonathan Curtis, Assistant Secretary, Research Branch. Welcome to the Library. It's my pleasure to kick off proceedings this morning, and I'll call on Mr. Ron Ramsey, MP, to introduce our speaker.
Well, thank you very much. Great to be here with you this morning, and Judith, welcome to the Parliamentary Library. Your book will be going in the Parliamentary Library, or one of the shelves, let me assure you. It is, historians are very important to Australia, and of course Alfred Deakin, we're talking over 100 years ago now, but it is still for us to operate correctly in this place, to map for the future, it is clear that we need to understand our past as well, and Judith is a long time professor of... I've got the wrong university, Judith. Which one is it?
And
she's recently retired. She said, that's how I have time to write books. And I did remark that some of my colleagues seem to find time to write books while they're in Parliament. And I often wonder how they do that. But congratulations on your work. I know it's not my job to give a critique on the book, but once you're in front of a crowd and you've got the opportunity to say something, I picked up the book and I thought, oh, well, I better get a bit familiar with it before I introduce Judith. I don't start at the start, you try and start at the meaty bits and you open up a few pages, and I was just captivated. I was well up the back half of the book and jumping from Deakin's diary entries, which Judith used extensively throughout the book, and let me read you one. And it said, Deakin took the boat to Queenscliff and his refuge on the sea, and this is in 1905. On New Year's Day, Paddy's 43rd birthday, he wrote, this is in his diary, life's shadow play is over for the year. Set free a foot upon this sandy rise. In ocean's breath, wild verdure, wilder skies, to home, heaven and thy heart, I draw thee more near. Man, he ought to see my diaries, he said. 100 years. And I said, had to slip around. Had to slip around for a meeting with Alan Tudge this morning. We spoke about this, this and this. Here's his phone number. I've got to get on to so-and-so. That absolute bore, terrible. The only thing I go back into my diary for is never looking for inspiration. I'm just looking for the phone number. It must have been a different time. But I wish I did write things like that in my diary, so in 100 years' time, somebody could go back and say, well, actually, this looks as a man of substance, not just a man looking for phone numbers and appointments. So I am really drawn. I will finish it. And she said it took her four years to write. I promised her it won't take me 4 years to read it. I am already captivated. I'm looking forward to the... I don't often look forward to plane journeys, but I'm looking forward to the next one when I can get my teeth into it properly. So thank you for your work and your dedication to the cause. Alfred Deakin, the second Prime Minister of Australia, 3 times Prime Minister for a total of less than 5 years. Something... politics is tumultuous in Australia today. I suspect it's been a little tumultuous for a while. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much. I hope you enjoy the book. And thank you very much to the Parliamentary Library for inviting me to do this. I know there's a lot of the staff here, and I want to say how much I value the research briefs and things that get put up online, which I made use of, and when I was teaching I used them a lot. They were a really fantastic way of giving students an introduction to a complex issue, so I'm very pleased to be here. Now, where's my first page gone? Did you pick up my first page?
What's it worth?
Thank you very much. Now, I've started off, I presume you know who the other person on the... on my PowerPoint is. It's Ned Kelly. And Alfred Deakin and Ned Kelly were born 2 years apart. Deakin was born in 1856, and they were both native sons of the newly proclaimed British colony of Victoria. Kelly's parents were an Irish ex-convict from Van Diemen's Land, and his spirited young Irish wife whereas Deacon was the only son of respectable gold rush immigrants, one of the thousands of young couples who were leaving England in the late 1840s for a better life. I've started with this because this is how I start the book. It's a way of... because Ned Kelly is really the only Victorian, 19th century Victorian, that most Australians have ever heard of. And it helps people, I think, to get back into the time if they realise that Deacon and Kelly are actually contemporaries. But I also start the book with that because it's a contrast between two very different lives that came out of those 1850s. Kelly was hanged on the 11th of November 1880 for murdering a policeman, and Deacon was there at the hanging in the old Melbourne jail. He was at that stage a reporter for The Age, but he was already a Member of Parliament. At that time, Members of Parliament weren't paid, so they needed to have a day job if they were to sit all through, say, Parliament started sitting at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. So he'd just become a new Member of Parliament, and he was at the start of a political stellar career when Kelly's life was over. 3 years later, he was already a minister. Now, where's the thing gone?
I think it did fall on the floor. It's a bit here it is.
Thank you.
Computer.
Thanks. Sorry. So he was already a minister, and in 1887 he represented Victoria in London at the Imperial Conference. This trip turned him into Victoria's most famous native son at that time, much more famous than Ned Kelly. He was brimming with self-confidence, and he was free of the ingrained patterns of class deference that people brought up in England had. And he argued with the British Prime Minister, Lord Salisbury, about Britain's refusal to annex the New Hebrides. He told him that any surrender to France over the islands would immediately weaken the colony's confidence in empire. This is face-to-face with the British Prime Minister. Lord Salisbury was astounded at the young colonial's audacity. Deacon was 30. But Deacon was absolutely thrilled with himself, as were other native-born men, who were even more thrilled when it became known that he'd refused a knighthood. And he returned a hero. And this is from a banquet that the Australian Natives Association gave for him to honour him on his return. By 1888, when the centenary of the First Fleet's arrival was being celebrated, Victoria was the leading Australian colony, and marvellous Melbourne was a world-class metropolis. The lawless frontier devilry of the Kelly gang had no place in the respectable society that the Gold Rush immigrants were building for themselves and their children. But it's the outlaw who survived most vividly in popular memory, and his crazy bravery has become a symbol of the defiance of authority that so many Australians like to believe is part of our character. Deacon is remembered too, but not as vividly. In Victoria State Library, where young Deacon spent many hours pursuing his passion for reading, there is not even a photo of him, whereas school children and tourists trooped past Kelly's armour. And it was that contrast, because I did quite a bit of research in the State Library, that made me think about starting the book with that contrast. Because although Deacon was Australia's most significant Prime Minister, I think, until World War II, he's an uneasy representative Australian figure. He's too urbane and too intellectual, too respectable and middle class for the larrikin masculinity of the Australian legend. He was never a mate. He didn't swear. He barely drank. He didn't play organised sport, and he didn't fight in the Great War. He was enormously well-read in philosophy, theology, comparative religion and the world literature, including poetry, his first love. And he wrote a poem for his wife every birthday and every wedding anniversary. So he was a middle-class, well-educated, supremely self-confident man, like the city of Melbourne and the colony in which he grew to manhood. By 2001, when the centenary of Federation was being celebrated, Deacon had faded to a face on an information board. He was a bearded worthy after whom things have been named, a suburb, an electorate, a university. He no longer lived in the contemporary national imagination, and part of the reason for writing the book was to try to bring him back to life for us today. And amongst those who follow politics closely, he'd become more of a cipher than a man. as both parties turned away from the protective policies of the early 20th century towards racially non-discriminatory immigration and neoliberalism's faith in open markets. Deakin came to represent the now discarded policies of tariff protection, state paternalism, centralised arbitration, imperial nationalism and the racism of white Australia. And these policies were shaped in the early decades of the 20th century, and Paul Kelly, in a way, summed that up for us very neatly and succinctly in his introduction to The End of Certainty. He called it, these policies, the Australian Settlement, and they've also been called the Deakinite Settlement. Now, the turn against Deakin was particularly evident in the Liberal Party, which under John Howard remade itself as the joint bearer of the liberal and conservative traditions in Australian politics. It reclaimed the free trade heritage of George Reid and adopted a reactive social conservatism. Deakin, Reid and Henry Bourne Higgins became counters in ideological arguments, which had little to do with the historical context of their actions and decisions. Yes, Deakin did support protection, white Australia, an active state, centralised industrial relations and imperial nationalism. And so, to varying degrees, did most of his fellow Australians. And if they weren't wholehearted supporters of all these policies, they were prepared to live with them. But that's why they became Australia's shared policy assumptions for three quarters of a century. Successful politicians in liberal democracies are not original thinkers. Their coin is the currency of the age and the society in which they compete for support. And so it was with Deakin. So it's not to the policies he supported that I think we should look for his achievements and his relevance to today, but to his statecraft and the urgent energy that he brought to his political work. So what were his achievements? Well, the first was federation. And here he is with Edmund Barton, who was the first Prime Minister. This photo was taken about 1898, before federation has been finally achieved. Deakin's the sort of leading federationist in Victoria and Barton in New South Wales. Deakin was a minister in the Victorian government from 1883 and chief secretary from 1886 till 1890, when he resigned from ministerial office and he went to the backbench where he stayed for the rest of the decade. Financial disaster was overtaking marvellous Melbourne. A speculative land and building boom crashed, along with most of the colony's financial institutions. Deakin was implicated in some of this, but he hadn't engaged in fraud to keep insolvent companies afloat, unlike some of his parliamentary colleagues. However, he and his government's optimism and its big spending schemes were shown to have been delusionary. The pressing task in the early 1890s was financial repair, which was something for which he had no appetite. And he contemplated leaving politics altogether. Deakin was very much an optimist, and when things went down, his optimism was sort of challenged. His energies failed him a bit. What held him in politics was the prospect of federation and the birth of a new nation. Federation became the redemption project for him, and he devoted himself to the cause, bringing to it his organisational skills, his oratory and his sense of dramatic urgency. Reflecting on the achievement of federation, he wrote that looking back, history can often appear inevitable. But for those who pursued the cause of federation, it was far from inevitable, as time and again its fortunes, and this is quoting, visibly trembled in the balance. Deakin had a sharp sense of the transience of moments of political opportunity, of how fleeting they were and how easily they could be lost, as they were in fact for Australia's Republicans. He brought a sense of drama to his political work, and at times it could seem a bit melodramatic when you read him, but it focused the minds of the political class and his own mind on what was at stake if courage failed. So achieving federation required compromise. The Victorian delegates to the conventions of the late 1890s that drafted the new constitution were unhappy about its undemocratic aspects, especially the makeup of the Senate, with the small states having the same representation as the well-populated New South Wales and Victoria. But Deakin knew that without this, federation wouldn't happen, and so he worked very hard behind the scenes to broker a compromise. Achieving federation, though, also required inspiration. The public had to be got behind the cause. And this is probably where Deakin's contribution is most well known. He led the movement in Victoria where his oratory lifted it from haggling over border duties to a test of men's souls. Deakin's speech in Bendigo to the Australian Natives Association in March 1898 was a turning point in a campaign that was heading for defeat. Let us recognise, he said, that we live in an unstable era, and that if we fail in the hour of crisis, we may never be able to recall our lost national opportunities. Deakin's words filled the listening men with zeal and sent them back to their branches to mobilise the campaign for the new nation. Now, with federation achieved, the next challenge Deakin took up was to lay the foundations of the new Commonwealth. When the Constitution was finally law and the Commonwealth inaugurated, Deakin saw it as the duty of those who'd argued for federation to actually make it work, to make it real. He was a first-rate administrator and a dedicated and able legislator. The Constitution, he said, provides us with a framework for the government of the nation, but that's all it was. It was a framework and it had to be filled out. Federal institutions had to be built and federal laws passed for areas of federal responsibility. And federal sentiment and a wide federal perspective had to be nurtured. Support for the federal union slumped in the early years, once voters confronted the expense and the states realised how much they had given up. I think that there was a real danger that if those early Commonwealth governments had failed, the new federation itself would fail, foundering on partisan differences and parochial jealousies and personal animosities. Western Australia, after all, was only just in, and 30 years later it would try to secede. North Queenslanders hadn't entirely given up the desire for a separate state above the 22nd parallel. So, and I think Deakin realised that it was really important that the government, new government, work. So again and again in his speeches after federation, Deakin conjured up the map of Australia, and he'd remind his audience that they were no longer just Victorians or South Australians or Tasmanians. They were now also Australians. This was Deakin's great mission in the federal parliament, to make real the promise of a nation that was carried in the Constitution. And he brought all his gifts, his courtesy and his capacity for unstinting work to the task. And he used the authority of the Prime Minister's office to project a national interest which was above and beyond party politics. Now, none of this was easy. We, until fairly recently, have become used to stable majority governments in Australia, and minority governments have a tendency to be treated as disastrous aberrations and sure signs of political dysfunction. But for the Commonwealth's first decade, minority governments were the norm. There were 7 changes of Prime Minister after Edmund Barton was sworn in as the first one, and only the last of these was the result of the government losing an election in 1910, when Labor, led by Andrew Fisher, won an absolute majority. So Deakin was Attorney General in Barton's cabinet. He was acting Prime Minister for 6 months in 1902 and Prime Minister for 3 times during that first decade, twice with the support of the Labor Party and once as the leader of a fusion government which, although it had a majority, had a great deal of internal tensions. These governments didn't achieve all of their legislation. This is a photo that I'm sure you've all seen of Deakin in 1903 when he becomes Prime Minister for the first time. They didn't achieve all of their legislation, but they did achieve a good deal. Some examples: the federal franchise, immigration restriction, the protective tariff, finally settling the site for the new capital, establishing the High Court, passing the Surplus Revenue Act, which made possible the first Commonwealth welfare measures, the old age and the invalid pensions. His governments laid the foundations for Australia's system of naval defence, assumed Commonwealth control of the former British New Guinea, and began the transfer of the Northern Territory to the Commonwealth. And much more. The detail's not the main message here. Rather it is that although he's leading a minority government, he was able to achieve a great deal. Now, this is partly because the party system was much looser than it is today, and parliamentary votes were more fluid. Deakin's Liberal Protectionist Party was the centre party between the new Labor Party that was rapidly increasing its electoral strength and the Free Traders anti-socialists led by ex-New South Wales Premier George Reid. Now, Deakin shared ideas and values with both the left and the right, and he worked to create a political centre for the new federation. Practical policies, he would describe these as, in the national interest, which had wide support. That's what he saw as his goal. So to get his legislation through, Deakin took support from wherever he could get it, and he compromised to achieve outcomes he believed were in the long-term national interest. He took this support more often from Labor than from the Conservatives, And when Labor won government in 1910, it completed much of his unfinished legislation within the already established broad bipartisan outlines. So it's the reality of bipartisanship in that period, I think, that you know, is really crucial to enabling his achievements. When he retired in 1913, Deakin was criticised for his weakness as a party leader by some people. But Deakin only ever saw party as a means to achieve policy outcomes, not as an end in itself. And he was untroubled by the imperatives of brand differentiation. The looser party system helped Deakin manage minority government, but so did his personality and political style. And this is a photo of Deakin, slightly older. It's on the US Congress site. And you can see something there, I think, of the amiability of his personality. He had the nickname Affable Alfred. With bright eyes and a ready smile, he was charming and courteous to men from all parties, and he used his charm and his skills to try to keep Parliament civil. He got on well with many Labor men, especially with Labor's first parliamentary leader, Chris Watson, whom he liked a great deal. He did have some personal antipathies, most notably with George Reid, but he hid them well, as he did much of his private thoughts and feelings. So with almost unfailing civility and determined optimism, Deakin turned what others might have regarded as a handicap into an opportunity. He argued that his dependence on Labor to pass legislation, and sometimes on members of the opposition or on independents, had not made him weak, but had rather strengthened his achievements. He claimed that it made his government's legislation not just the achievement of one party, but organic Australian policy and the fruit of wide Australian experience. That is, Deakin assumed the existence of a consensual centre, if you like, an existing public opinion, which it was the job of politicians to realise in institutions and legislation. And as Prime Minister, he confidently spoke for that centre, for the interests of the nation as a whole, and not just the part of it which voted for him and his party. So Deakin was not a political warrior. He didn't use anger and denigration as political weapons. And if he were insulted, he just pretended not to notice. If he had to compromise to achieve his ends, he acted as if this is what he'd intended all along. If tempers were rising, he would relieve the tension with a joke. He did everything he could to try to prevent the escalation of conflict in order to keep open possibilities of cooperation and agreement. After fusion, he was faced with relentless personal attacks. This is the period when Billy Hughes is calling him Judas and traitor, and William Lynn is calling him traitor all the time. He adopted, in the face of these relentless personal attacks, what he described as Fabian tactics, after the Roman commander Fabius Maximus, who avoided pitched battles with the invading armies of Hannibal in favour of a war of attrition. And this is what he writes in his diary. By studied moderation of tone, refusal to resent insult, and by the strict suppression of my own speech and that of my friends, so far as I could influence them, I let the storm beat upon us until it died of inanition, while we meekly and patiently waited until their wrath melted away. So no returning fire with fire here. I want now to say something briefly about the way Deakin handled foreign affairs, where he could act without the support of Parliament. So the fact that he's a leader of minority government there is not a problem for him. When Deakin and Barton were working out how to divide up ministerial responsibilities, which they did even before Barton had become Prime Minister, they were so confident that they would be in the lead seats. Deakin was adamant that the Prime Minister should take external affairs, and this was the norm until World War II. Occasionally there was an independent minister for external affairs, but mostly it was the Prime Minister. As Australian foreign policy was contained within imperial foreign policy, this role was mainly confined to dealings with the British government through the Colonial Office. And Deakin, I think, thought that having the weight of the Prime Minister's position would help with those dealings. Now, when he became Prime Minister, Deakin was already fully aware of potential tensions between imperial strategic interests, as seen from London, and the view from the edge of the Pacific, where we were. He was a young member of Parliament in the early 1880s, when Australian colonists were pushing Britain to annex the New Hebrides, to forestall the French, and the eastern half of New Guinea to forestall the Germans. In neither case, however, was Britain interested in acquiring new territory in the Pacific. The British Prime Minister, Lord Salisbury, thought the Australians the most unreasonable people, wanting us, he said, to incur all the danger and cost of a war with France for a valueless group of faraway islands. And this is what Deakin confronted Salisbury on in 1887, and the issue had continued to rankle with him. He was always a loyal imperialist, but the annexation crisis brought home to him the reality of the differing priorities of London and Australia, and it laid down a lifelong distrust of the colonial office. Twice in his second prime ministership, Deakin initiated diplomatic negotiations with a foreign power without going through London. The first was when he negotiated directly with the Japanese Consul General over the administration of the Immigration Act in relation to Japanese nationals. The Japanese had no objection at all to the government's desire to control their immigration. They, as a government, would do the same thing. What they objected to was being lumped in with other coloured peoples whom they regarded as uncivilised and inferior to them, the Japanese. So it was agreed that Japanese nationals would be exempted from the dictation test, and instead the Japanese government would issue them with a visa which prevented permanent settlement. So the Japanese government took responsibility for controlling their immigration to Australia. The colonial office reminded Deakin that it expected Australia to conduct any dealings with a foreign power through London. Deakin replied that though he agreed with this in principle, he reserved the right to conduct preliminary and unofficial discussions. Now, he used this defence again in 1908 when he unofficially invited the American Great White Fleet to visit Australia as part of a round-the-world trip. He made sure that the American government received his unofficial invitation before the British government even heard of it. And after he unofficially announced a likely visit from the fleet, the furious British government had little choice but to agree. Deakin hoped that the visit of the American fleet would encourage Britain to take Australia's security needs more seriously. It was an immensely popular event, and there's a lot of memorabilia associated with it. If you put Great White Fleet an image into Google, you get this with postcards and souvenirs and special dinners and marches of the American sailors down the main streets. It was enormously popular. And Deakin used the occasion to celebrate the invisible ties between the two nations. Australia was not in a position to make its own alliance across the Pacific, but it could strengthen its friendship with the United States. And as Prime Minister, Deakin was determined to develop Australia's naval capacity and to claim some unofficial independence in dealing with foreign powers in Australia's part of the world. Now, in these independent diplomatic dealings, Deakin was establishing the first outlines of Australia's international personality. And significantly, they were in matters relating to the Pacific. Deakin early recognised the strategic importance of the Pacific to Australia and the possibility that Australia's defence needs may not always be the same as Britain's or the Empire's. And that is what came to a head with the Japanese invasion in World War II. Now, Deakin's assertion of independence in relation to the colonial office is relatively well known. Less well known, I think, is the clarification when he was acting Prime Minister of the exclusive power of the Commonwealth in relation to external affairs. Some Dutch sailors had deserted in Adelaide from a ship called the Fondel. When the Dutch consul requested assistance from the South Australian government to apprehend them under the Anglo-Dutch Convention, the South Australian government refused. The Dutch government complained to the colonial office in London, which in turn asked Deakin to intervene. All perfectly straightforward, it would seem, except that the South Australian government objected to receiving communications from the colonial office through the Commonwealth. It thought it should have received the communications directly, as had been the case prior to Federation. It was a belligerent assertion of the state's rights to maintain the direct lines of communication with the colonial office that they previously enjoyed. And this was the first test case of the scope of the Commonwealth's external affairs power, and Deakin stood his ground. The matter was finally resolved by Colonial Secretary Joseph Chamberlain, who said, "The people of Australia form one political community for which the government of the Commonwealth alone can speak, and for everything affecting external state or communities which take place within its borders, that government is responsible. Now, I'm going to conclude by an explanation of the title and the cover. This is a photograph of Deakin in 1909 with Joseph Cook. It's in the garden of Deakin's holiday house at Point Lonsdale, Ballara, which is actually still in the family's hands. And the downstairs room in particular, the sort of sitting room, is pretty much unchanged since Deakin's time. I spent quite a bit of time staying there when I was first thinking about Deakin, sitting on the veranda reading a lot of what he'd written when he was down there after he'd left politics. So the title, The Enigmatic Mr. Deakin, was based on one of the anonymous letters that Deakin wrote about Australian politics in the London Daily, and it was about the fusion. In early 1909, it's become clear that the two non-Labor parties, in order to really mount a proper electoral challenge to Labor, are going to need to come to some sort of accommodation. While George Reid had been leading the Conservatives, Deakin's antipathy with him was such that that was not really likely. He'd resigned, left Parliament, and Joseph Cook was the new leader. And here they are discussing the terms and possibilities of the two parties coming together. Now, Deakin had begun writing for the London Daily, the Morning Post, in 1900. He was writing regular letters from Australia. They were anonymous. He signed himself The Australian Correspondent. And he continued these letters until 1913. Now, it wasn't uncommon for politicians to write anonymously for the press, but it was uncommon for prime ministers to do so. So in 1909, these negotiations were proceeding. Deakin wrote, "For reasons known only to himself, which are a perpetual subject of controversy in our press, Mr. Deakin pursues his enigmatic methods of action. In spite of his persistent elusiveness, the pressures brought to bear upon him appear so strong that some unexpected development must be near at hand." And so I took the title, The Enigmatic Mr. Deakin, from that quote. I must admit, I don't quite understand the reasons for this playful double life that Deakin led. But one of the things to note about that quote I've just read is that Deakin makes himself and his own decisions the absolute centre of the action. So once it's made clear what Mr. Deakin's thinking, then everything will fall into place. And this is the cover photo of the book. This is Deakin in 1910 on the front beach at Point Lonsdale, where he and Patty had been having family summer holidays since the 1890s, and where they built a house which is still in the family's hands. The book, I should say, this little ad, is available in the bookshop. I've signed a whole lot of copies of it down there. Now, I chose this photo for many reasons. I didn't want to use one of those official photos because I wanted to communicate with potential readers that this was a book about a man who was really interesting and surprising. It wasn't a dry, official political biography. You know, that it was a trade book. It wasn't a sort of an academic treatise. And so I wanted something that was a bit surprising, that didn't look like just, you know, the face on the information boards that people already knew. So I chose it then partly because it unsettled the image of him as a bearded worthy. And also because, unlike today, it's not so common for us to see our early politicians togged out for swimming. I thought it had a sort of a bit of a resonance there. It also showed what a strong, handsome man Deakin was. He was 6'2". He was always described as handsome. He believed in exercise. He loved swimming. He would swim all through the year. And it's pretty cold swimming in the Southern Ocean in July, without a wetsuit, which didn't exist then. He would swim at night in the nude, as men did in those days. So it gave you a sense of his physical strength. And politics is a physically arduous business, and he was built for it, and particularly for the oratory. But it also puts him on the edge of the sea, just inside the heads of Port Phillip Bay, where all of that tidal energy surges back and forth. And Deakin has a very well-developed and profound inner religious life. And for him, he's partly shaped by Wordsworth and Coleridge and the Romantics. And he sees the universe, the divinity of the universe, which is apparent, you know, with the infinity of the sea and the sky, as holding the divinity of God in that sense. And so it seemed to me it also captured something of his inner life. And I sort of like the way he was standing on the edge of the sea there, looking back over his shoulder at us today. Thank you. Now, I'm told we have time for questions, don't we? So, do you want me to do that, or you do that, or?
Sure. Great talk. Looking forward to reading it, and your work's been very useful for when I was at uni.
Well, that's good to hear. It's still useful.
Yes. So, part of the story, from what I can tell, of the first decade is also predating fusion. Is the slow, despite Deakin's great successes, the slow electoral decline of the protectionists, yeah, often at the expense of labour. Why do you think that was?
I think what was happening electorally is that Deakin, in a way, comes out of the sort of gold rush era and colonial liberalism, where there is a belief in the progress of the colony and development as something which is, in a sense, it's not even bipartisan because there's not two sides yet. It's something which has wide popular acceptance. And what happens with Labor is you start to get class identity coming in as a basis for political identification. Now, Deakin never understands class, in my view. He sees himself as very sympathetic to the plight of working men, but it's a middle-class humanitarian sympathy. He doesn't, because he has a very, his parents are not wealthy, but it's a very small family. There's only two children, and he has a pretty socially, economically stable life, and he gets well educated, he goes to university. He never understands the sort of grievance that drives working class labour politics. And so in some ways he's sort of operating in that period as labour is wanting to sharpen up lines of division and brings in the language of class, which Deakin just in a sense doesn't even refuse to engage. He just doesn't engage with it. He just doesn't see. I don't think he actually understands what it's about at some level. And so it's like the political landscape is sort of changing under his feet, which is most obvious at the electoral level. And this is because of Labor's success in mobilising working class political identities, in my view, which then, you know, force. And George Read is onto this much earlier, because in the New South Wales Parliament, when he's Premier in the 1890s, he faces a very aggressive Labor Party, and he's got a much clearer sense of what the longer term implications are of that mobilisation of class identities into politics.
Judy, excellent talk. This notion of Deakin as enigmatic, as we know, that goes to contradictions in the man.
Yeah.
That when you start to read into his work, absolutely astounds you, not least that you go into the archives at the National Library to find so much that he has written, and he's written at night. And we understand that no one ever saw any of that, yeah, of course, until after he had died. So here's a man who's going into the colonial parliament and then into the federal parliament, who is going home at night and producing literally thousands of pages, where he is, I think one of the phrases he used at one point was to find out God.
Yeah.
And a man who shifts from fairly, well, what he ultimately found to be rather embarrassing early spiritualism into a metaphysical quest that was, yes, he was very much the loner. That makes him the more, far more the interesting individual as Prime Minister than he might otherwise have been. There's all the achievement in the Parliament, there's the Australian settlement, and then there's everything that was happening in this private life when,
yeah,
he was going home. As we know, more or less famously, Lanoz didn't give too much attention to that into the biography of the 1960s. And the, you know, the what does one say, the people are looking for the political story when in fact this man, who didn't particularly like sport as we know, that's where so much of the personal energy was going. Can you comment a little bit more on that, his yeah. metaphysical quest that was with him his entire life?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things, I mean, you're quite right, it's very puzzling because most of that metaphysical quest, I mean, he keeps a prayer diary, for example, from 1884 till all through his prime ministership, all through his political career, there's a prayer diary. He doesn't write in it every night, but he writes in it at significant moments and turning points. He is always periodically thinking about whether he should resign from politics and do something else. For a while, he flirts with the idea of being a preacher and going into some sort of religious vocation. So there's a sort of ambivalence about politics, yet he stays in politics. So one of the puzzles for me is, I mean, people are going to read a biography about him because of his political contribution, so not because of his pretty unoriginal religious writing, of which, as you write, there is thousands and thousands of words, was to try to think what connection there is. Now, a lot of the time, there isn't a huge connection. It's like this private space that he goes into when he studies at night is where he re-centres himself. I mean, and I think prayer, it's a bit like we would now think about it in terms of meditation or something. He sort of goes back to who he is and why he's there. But I also think he has this strong desire to serve God. That's after he gets through his early spiritualism, which I have to say was very difficult to write because some of it is really bizarre. But as he gets through that and moves into a more conventional Christian way of thinking with the notion of service, of putting his life to the service of the divine cause, I think by the time he becomes Prime Minister, he realises, and he's by then, you know, in his early 50s, that this is it. You know, if he's going to do something with his life, if he's going to make a serve, this is where he happens to be. This is where he's going to make his contribution. And I think that in some ways gave him the energy to persist in politics, because there was much about politics that he found distasteful. On the other hand, although he keeps saying that he wants to resign, he actually doesn't. I mean, he stays there. You know, politics is what he does. And so part of the puzzle that the religious life posed for me was, okay, this is all the things you're saying about yourself, but if I look at what you actually do with your life, what you do is get up on your hind legs and speak and you know, scheme in Parliament and give speeches to arouse people's passions. I think there was much, particularly about the oratory, which really appealed to him. I think he liked the adrenaline of the political life. And that there was certainly in his early career, when there's a lot more of that sort of oratory, that it's part of the adrenaline of oratory that, in a sense, keeps him in politics. But you're quite right. I mean, it's one of the things that makes him a very interesting biographical subject, because mostly with politicians, there's not a lot of inner life. They don't... you know, when I wrote Robert Menzies' Forgotten People, I was teaching a course in political biography at that stage, and I was teaching it with a friend of mine, and we would say to the students, you know, rich public life, poor inner life. You know, the politicians were on the whole externalisers. They dealt with things out there in the world. They were the problems that they were interested in. They weren't that interested in themselves. And Deakin is not like that. You've got this extraordinarily rich inner life, and the accident of his dementia, which meant that it wasn't destroyed. I mean, I'm sure if he'd lived with all his faculties, he would have destroyed a lot of this material and it wouldn't have stayed there for the biographer. But the family didn't know it existed, and he gets dementia. Well, you know, by end of 1916, he's pretty much lost his capacity for any sort of executive action, and he's losing his capacity for rational discourse. And so they find all these books of after he dies, and in a way I'm quite sympathetic with Lanoz for, you know, not really quite knowing what to do with it. I mean, and because they're not, most of it's dated, but there's all these parallel series. There's the prayer diary, and then there's a series called Clues, which is sort of, I read it as clues to the meaning of life or the meaning of the universe, but it's an eclectic collection of notes on his reading, aphorisms, short stories, ideas, you know, that to try to work that into a biography is pretty demanding.
Thanks. So you mentioned that Deakin shared a lot of his kind of political positions with lots of the contemporary politicians of the time, but I was wondering if you could just comment on his views on women's suffrage, and perhaps either politically or religiously.
Yeah, he always saw himself as a supporter of votes for women. He was one of the things about his early identification with spiritualism. His spiritualism was not just a set of wacky religious ideas. It did have a set of sort of progressive liberal ideas. It was fairly committed to equal rights for women. And so women's suffrage, and it saw itself as progressive, politically progressive. So he always supports it, but he isn't someone who puts that as one of the causes that he actively works for. Unlike, say, legislation to prevent cruelty to animals, which is the first bill that he proposes when he's a young member of parliament. He's very is in that area. So he doesn't he votes for it, but he doesn't actively advocate for it. And my sense is that he doesn't really see women as political agents. It's something that's sort of happening around him. His wife and mother and sister all sign the monster petition for women's suffrage that is held in the Victorian Parliament in the early 1890s.
Judy, at the end of his career, before the dementia kicked in, did he see himself as having been a success? In retrospect, did he see his career as being meeting what he wanted?
The dementia is kicking in before his career ends. Mm. He's aware from about 1907 of some losses of short-term memory. It's not, this sort of retrospective medical diagnosis is quite difficult. I mean, I thought it might have been early onset dementia, but I now think it was probably some form of vascular dementia, maybe small strokes caused by chronic hypertension, because he has episodes when he's quite ill and can't go on, and then he sort of, it's like his head clears and he's fine for a while. So by the time he finishes, and he also, by that time, he's a very experienced parliamentarian, so he's able to function in Parliament and function in political situations almost out of habit. You know, he can... So people around him don't know the extent to which he's struggling, and it's only because of the access to the private writings that we know that he's really struggling through some of that. So by the time he retires, he's actually just so relieved to have survived, and everybody's terribly shocked that he wants to retire, and they think, oh, he can just have a little bit of a rest, and then he could perhaps come back into the Senate or something. So he doesn't, in the last... His last period as Prime Minister, he gets through a whole lot of legislation that had been pending for a while, and he writes, you know, I'm really pleased that was a rich harvest of legislation, but he doesn't ever sort of reflect on the whole life. When he reflects on his whole life, he just says, I was blessed. I've had a fortunate life. I've been very happy in my family, in my marriage, in my work. But it starts to become relatively conventional.
Sorry,
I have
time for one more question.
Sorry.
Any final questions before we wrap up?
Yeah.
Your phone.
Yeah, it's just for fun. It'll just.
Oh, Alex, sorry.
You said that Deakin went to the back bench at the time of the crash.
Yeah.
Was he a kind of front runner, someone who was good at winning more than more than it slogging away in opposition?
Well, I think he was, yes, he was also an optimist. I actually think he went to that bench because he just didn't know what to do. There was a lot of pressure on him to take over the leadership. And in some ways, he may have rallied the colony spirits at that time because, you know, Victoria was pretty depressed. I think he wasn't particularly good at finances. He'd been personally implicated in some of the... He was the chairman of one of the building societies that went down and took a lot of people's money. I don't think it was so much the hard slog as opposition as he didn't really know. It was more the hard slog of sorting out the finances, you know, of having to introduce stringent, you know, austerity measures and that sort of thing. Because he was a pretty hard worker, but he wanted to feel that he was working with the direction of progress, of the sort of progress within the universe. And when that sort of halted, it's like his spirit failed him, I think. So I don't think it was just a show pony.
We should probably leave it there. Judy, thanks for a very, very interesting talk, and I really look forward to reading the book. As Judy mentioned, you can scamper down and buy a signed copy down in the shop. But the library itself, I believe, has four copies on the shelf. Well, they're not on the shelves, they're all out on loan, which is a testament to its readability.
So it'd be a good Christmas present for Father. That's what I
think. And once you're fully inspired with the story of Mr. Deakin, Dave Heaton's book on Deakin as well should be coming out before too much longer. I should also say Mr. Ramsey sent his apologies at having to leave early.
That's okay.
Something came up, as these things do for parliamentarians. So I'm concluding proceedings on his behalf. So on that note, thank you all for coming, and please join me in thanking Judy Brett. Now, you may have noticed that there's some tea and coffee in the back, so if you'd like to continue the conversation, please stay for some morning tea. I think we deserve a coffee after all.